Julian is going to talk to us about motion capture, a very short and perhaps to some rather cryptic title. But as we will hear, the work of Julian and his colleagues lies at something of a fork in a tree, where some branches are growing towards goals that are perhaps of immediate and obvious value to mankind, and other branches seem to wish to grow towards the sunshine, the glitz and glamour not of Hollywell, but of Hollywood. So in Southern California style, I've rolled out the red carpet, and I think we should all welcome Dr. Julian Morris onto it.
Thank you very much, David. That was getting quite poetic. I was rather hoping you might carry on for the next 45 minutes, because I'm afraid this will seem a little dry after that. It's a real honor to be here back in the department. I was extremely surprised and delighted when Andrew asked if I would be willing to do this many months ago. Only my wife here my wife and some of my colleagues will tell you how anxious I'm feeling about making this presentation to such a distinguished audience. The problem, of course, is made the more difficult by the fact that there are people in the room, both from the department and my colleagues at work, who are very expert in this field, certainly more expert these days than I am, and others, some of whom I've invited myself, who for the last 25 years have been saying, what exactly is it that you do? And I saw this as an opportunity to answer the question quite thoroughly. My intention is to keep an eye on the clock. It's now 5:08, and I hope to be finished in about 45 minutes, no more. So there should be time before the reception you've all kindly been offered to ask questions at the end. But I would like to say with completely genuinely that if there is something which I say which puzzles you or interests you, I really, really don't mind if you ask a question. Just raise your hand while I'm talking. I don't think it will throw me off my stride. The main difficulty will be that I'll go off and give you a completely different lecture than the one intended. But if you are moved to do so, please feel free to interrupt. As David said, I had the honour to do my DPhil in the department coming here from University College in London, where I did a degree in electrical engineering. And the first person that I met in the department is someone I still see very regularly. And it might surprise you to know it's Caroline Harding, because she, of course, was Douglas Holder's secretary. And when I came for the very first time to the department, I came in and I went up that scary paternoster that was there to the 9th floor and met Carolyn and then Douglas. And Professor Holder had kindly arranged for me to meet a number of people who might be interested in motion capture, which was what I wanted to do some research on. And I did a round robin of a few people one or two people who were in the room and one or two people, sadly, who are no longer with us, and ended up, to my eternal delight, as a student of John O'Connor's from 1969, as the slide said. The department was a really friendly and charming place in those days, and apart from the academic staff, a person who I remember with huge affection was Rodney Parsons, who was running the department at the time. John's office was in a building which used to be roughly where your staff coffee room is now. And John had a lovely office looking out over the university parks. I was dumped in a shared office, as graduate students were, still are, and should be, a shared office quite a long way away up in Bevington Road above Brian Belthouse's gurgling machines. And I didn't like it very much. And after I'd been here a few weeks, I noticed that there was a door next to John's office. I somehow went up to the general office and had a look at the map, because I never saw anyone going in and out of that door. and eventually discovered that it was an office that wasn't on the map. One quiet evening I broke into it and found quite a spacious office that was completely unknown to Rodney Parsons. And I set myself up in there. And what's more, all the phone lines for the building came through that office, and there was a junction box there, and I found an old phone and wired myself in. And 6 months into my DPhil, I was as well set up as the deputy head of department. But unfortunately, only if John may remember this, on a day when I wasn't around, Rodney Parsons was showing some insurers or somebody around the department, and he was sort of opening doors and saying, I think John rather got it in the neck, I have to be, among so many other things, I have to be grateful for John, that by the time I returned, Rodney had calmed down and I was allowed to stay there. So I had a very comfortable and pleasant time in the department. Anyway, I digress. So it's now 12 minutes past. So,
what were you doing in this preliminary area?
I was trained to be noticed.
You get a kick out of
it. I like people to be interested in me. Don't you?
Not playing games. First name, last name, age and occupation.
Okay. My name is F. Solal. I'm 23 years old and I work for Attitude Studio.
Okay. Yeah, sure. Well, I'm going to pull the sound out. That's not a real person. It's a very good example of what can be achieved these days by motion capture. I have no idea what shape or appearance the person who did the original performance had. None of us has. It's very likely that the very realistic shape was scanned from an individual, but it wasn't necessarily the person whose eye movements, whose lip movements, whose cheek movements you see. And that is one of several things that has been made possible in ways that I never imagined back in 1969 and later when we started the business with motion capture. David's kindly introduced a bit of what we do. The origins of the motion capture system which Oxford Metrics manufactures, which is called Vicon. This is the only advertising I'm going to do all evening with our current logo, the first system was delivered to two colleagues of John O'Connor's, or I say colleagues in the sense of collaborators, Eric Radin and Igor Paul, who worked at the University of West Virginia, and they were being quite nasty to sheep and were giving them osteoarthrosis and then measuring, walking them for hours and hours and days on a treadmill. They said to me that actually the treadmill was most convenient because they put the hay in one end and the poops got conveniently carried away at the other end of the treadmill. But they have the distinction of being the customers for the world's first three-dimensional motion capture system. That at that time, we had no idea where it was going to go. The second system went to Boston Children's Hospital and the third system to Saitama Rehabilitation Center. And in fact, there is there's a very little known connection with this department, with the development of that first system, in that there was an engineer here called Malcolm Herring, who now lives in Portland, Oregon, and is still a friend of mine, who was looking after your one and only computer in 1980, in a room over there somewhere. And in the evenings, Malcolm designed the electronics for this system for us. The software was written by a chap called Graham Klein, who I don't think is here. So those two people were absolutely fundamental to us being able to get the first system off the ground. Years passed, And by last year, we estimate that the market for motion capture products and services is very likely in excess of $50 million per annum. So it's substantial, but not in all, you know, it's quite respectable. The company that we set up in 84, because Vicon actually started life within, as David's explained, Oxford Instruments, last year delivered about 250 motion capture systems, which included of the order of 3,000 image processing cameras, and some of the designers of those cameras are here this afternoon. And those systems, those 250 systems, and all the hundreds that have gone out before, are used these days for measuring disabled patients in orthopaedic hospitals. They're used, as David's alluded to, making feature films and numerous other engineering tasks, including, as I will show you, helping with the design of cars and aeroplanes and so on and so forth. But the curious thing is that over that very long period, the principle of operation of the system really hasn't changed at all. There can't be very many technologies of which that is true. The thing that lies at the heart of motion capture as we understand it is retroreflection. In 1951, I believe, Hollywood decided that an economic way of filming their cowboys was to put them on a horse in the studio, or a dummy horse, and project the range behind them. Well, they tried rear projection onto a translucent screen, but they found that what was much more effective was to project through the same camera as they were shooting the cowboy from the front, and have a highly reflective screen behind the cowboy, so that part of Arizona was projected onto the cowboy and his horse, but it was so dim that you didn't perceive it. But what you did see was, without any shadows at all, was because they were coming out of the same lens, was this highly reflected image of the background. And the material that was developed for that is known by the trade name Scotchlight, made by 3M. And during the 1970s, various people in biomechanics recognized its potential as a way of creating targets which could be tracked. We actually use exactly the same material, Scotchlight 7610, today. We manufacture these little dots by the hundred of thousand, by a variety of, and up there you can see next to a 5p coin we've tried lots of different methods, but it's a real sweatshop job, because we've never found a better quality than taking the original film and cutting it and wrapping it around a sphere. Now, the spheres come in a variety of sizes. The original ones were actually manufactured doll's heads, and we've used Muppet eyes, and all sorts of things like that. But the coating is always the same, this Scotch-like material. And you can see this poor chap here with a rather bad case of retroreflective acne has got, I think they're probably 3 millimeter markers all over his face. Now, originally, the markers we used were much larger. You're going to see some of the sensors that we used to use in a minute. the original markers were about an inch in diameter. Now, the three people who should be credited with developing this idea were, first of all, a professor in the University of Waterloo in Canada called David Winter, who retired about 10 years ago. Another gentleman in the University of Leiden called Hans Fernet, and a graduate student at the University of Strathclyde called Mick Jarrett. And it was through Mick that I got, some time after leaving the department here, to thinking of the idea that this idea might be commercialized. Now, because the material is retroreflective, if you can put a light source very close to the lens, nearly all the light comes back along the path along the reflected light comes along the incident path, whatever angle you project the light. So if you, as you'll see again later, if you put a strobe of lights around the lens, enough of the light spills into the lens to give you a very bright image. And over here you can see from one of our cameras the sort of image, if you've got the resolution for it, that we analysed today. So, and I'll explain a bit more about what the circle and the green cross is all about in a minute. So that's the principle, and what's been going on over the past 30-odd years is what I'm calling engineering evolution. We've taken this principle and we've engineered it, and it seems to be a particularly good way of developing products which people buy, rather than having wholly original ideas, because it gives you the chance to respond to user requirements. And one has to acknowledge it also a very significant factor, which is more Darwinian, is that you also give an engineering response to what your competitors are doing. And we've never been the only business in motion capture. There are others. We are today by far the largest, but we've been given some fairly good scares by engineering developments done by our competitors, and all those, almost without exception, have served to improve our own product. And it's that theme which I want to try and trace and then show some illustrations at the end. I can't find a picture of our very first camera, but except this scanned one from a very old brochure. But what I do know very well, because I remember the beastly things, is that in those days when we first launched it, we were talking about tube cameras, 1-inch ultracon tubes in great big cast-iron boxes. They were designed for closed-circuit TV, and we resprayed them and used them, and they... our customers, to get any kind of stability, used to have to leave the system turned on for 3 or 4 hours before they could make any serious measurements. There was another great advantage to cameras of that sort compared with the sort of thing we use today. I remember taking a system to Zurich to sell to the technical high school there, who are, again, still a customer. And one of the, I think it was just a 3 or 4 camera system, and one of the cameras blew up. I was able to take 4 screws off, take the lid up, see that the bridge rectifier in the power supply had blown up, go down the street in Zurich, buy a replacement and solder it in, and carry on with the demonstration with only an hour's interruption. And the idea of being able to do that with anything we make today is just quite impossible. So there were merits, but it was a pretty beastly thing, but it certainly did work. We've had an enormous array of cameras through the history of motion capture, but I'm just going to pick out 4, because in 1991, was the first time we got into frame rates that were significantly different from broadcast. And this camera, which was manufactured for the aerospace industry by the company that became our Japanese distributor, ran at 200 hertz with a VGA picture, and it was shuttered, as the previous one was not, but shuttered by a mechanical shutter. There was a rotating disc so that if you flashed your strobe, the shutter has the advantage of improving the contrast, because if the illumination you want, which is your strobe flash, goes off while the shutter's open and then you close the shutter, you don't get ambient light coming in through the rest of the cycle. So shuttering can be very useful. So this was quite a milestone, and was the move by Vicon into the high speed, but it was actually a slightly lower resolution than the other cameras at the time. 9 years later, we tried out lots of different cameras from different people and decided that they really didn't fit the bill. So we took the fairly drastic step of saying, okay, we're going to build our own camera. And this was the first one we built. It was developed over the late 90s and introduced in 2000. It used by then a CMOS sensor, and we couldn't get one that was shuttered. we did a lot of tests and decided that we could cope in many circumstances without having a shutter. But it was a megapixel. And I've referred to the competitive element in this engineering evolution. And it is quite extraordinary how even quite sophisticated customers fixate on one feature of your product. You can have a product which is absolutely dire to use, has a terrible user interface and all the rest of it, but as long as it's got more megapixels than anybody else, they'll buy it. So over the last 7 or 8 years, we really have had a bit of a megapixel war going on, and we're winning. So that was the first camera that we manufactured ourselves. But if we leap forward to today, we've increased the number of megapixels, as you can see, up to 4. We've got a shuttered device, and it can run, I think that figure is rounded up rather than down, to around 400 hertz at full frame. So we're told by people who you would expect to know quite a lot about high-performance cameras that this actually stands like the US Department of Defense are very interested in a camera that has this very high combination of resolution and high frame rate with an integrated shutter. The other big thing in this camera is that a lot of the image processing is actually done inside the camera. But I'll be telling you a bit more about that. So in order to achieve that level of specification, we had to do another fairly drastic thing, which you might consider rather surprising for a company of our relatively small size, which is to start making our own sensors. So these are the sensors that are inside that camera. You can't buy them anywhere. They're made for us, and they go in that camera. If someone offers us an awful lot of money to use them for something that isn't competitive with what we'll do, we would sell them. But it is really quite a complex device that was designed quite specifically for the camera. And then the insides of the camera look deceptively simple on that side of the board. The lens sticks out. The chaps who have to make and design these things are chuckling. So the lens sticks out in the front. But when you flip the thing over, it's rather more complicated on the other side. I believe the sort of printed circuit board we need to use these days is made up of, for those of you who aren't electronic engineers, sort of state of the art is now the interconnections on boards like this make up 14 different layers. So this printed circuit board is a sandwich of 14 layers of fiberglass and copper, with interconnects between them. Quite a complicated thing to have to design. Right, I'm not going to say any more in detail about the sensors, but I hope that gives you an impression of the evolution of the sensors. I want to look next at system architecture, and this is the oldest picture that I can find. I think it dates from about 1985 of the system, a motion capture system as it was then. It is ours, but competitive mocap systems would have looked very similar. And if I take my little wand here, I don't want to try using the mouse. I think I can reach to point out various things. In those days, you put the system inside the computer rather than today you put the computer inside the system. This was all a computer. It had two disk drives of 2.5 megabytes each. And the processor was here, and we had graphics. I know that's a golf swing. What it has to do with her, I'm not sure. But anyway, this was a publicity shop. And you can see those old brown cameras. So the essential elements were some electronics that Malcolm Herring designed in those days that shoved into a PDP-11 computer, and then we would deliver it with one disk for your software and one disk to store your data on, and a couple of terminals. The number of cameras shown here was fairly typical of early systems 4, and this device is key to the whole thing, because the novelty of Vicon when it came out was that it actually allowed you to measure in three dimensions, which hadn't been done in biomechanics before. In order to be able to place the cameras anywhere you like, you clearly had to have some means of determining where the cameras were. And the calibration procedure involved, I told you that these cameras used to take 3 or 4 hours to warm up. Well, we actually made that into an advantage, because the calibration used to take nearly that long. and that was because we used to put hooks in the ceiling and hang steel wires with markers on, and then using this theodolite, very, very carefully measured the position of all these markers. And it would take about an hour. If someone came into the room while you were calibrating and a draft blew all the and all the markers started going like this, there were words spoken. And, so the setup really was quite complicated. But having observed these markers, I forget how many there were, 16 or so in known positions, and the known positions all determined by that, you could then calculate the positions of the cameras and from that reconstruct the markers. The other thing to notice is how few markers the girl has on. This was fairly typical of gait analysis in those days. She's got three on her foot, one on the side of her knee, and one on her hip, and she probably has the same on the other leg. So a set of 13, 14 markers was very typical of gait analysis in the early days. You notice there were four cameras, and I just want to, it's always amused me how decisions made for fairly arbitrary reasons end up determining rather fundamental things about systems. In the very beginning, we decided that there should be 10 data bits, 3 camera code bits, and 3 what we called event bits there. And this was the data structure for what the system used. And the data, because all the cameras were synchronized, you could detect a marker on camera one up here at horizontal position 20. And then on the same line, you might detect something from camera seven at position 308. And I've shown it, camera four then came in with a coordinate of 865, and then you'd give the line number, which I've shown here is 82, and then it would go and on the next line, which I'm standing in the way of, 84. We just got one coordinate, but by the decision to have just 3 bits and one of those codes to represent the line count, we locked ourselves into a maximum of 7 cameras for 19 years. you've got to be very careful when you decide, we'll never need more than that many, as you'll see in a minute. But it was rather a fateful decision, but it is something we've now been able to break through. This picture's fuzzy. It's not your eyes, and it's fuzzy because our management don't want you to see it very clearly. Because it's the block diagram for a camera which is in development at the moment, but the camera to which it applies hasn't been introduced yet. But it has a sensor, which may or may not be the one you've been shown and I've talked about. Or it might have more megapixels. What a surprise. You know that story. It as so much electronics does these days, it has an enormous FPGA. So enormous, indeed, that inside that FPGA, we put a processor which it's trite to say it's many times. This is inside one camera. The processor, which is really, that one's only doing some housekeeping and a bit of thinking, is certainly more powerful than that great big cabinet we saw at the very beginning. And attached to it, there's some memory. And I've actually checked the memory in the camera here. There's 1,000 times as much memory as there was in the whole system at the very beginning. And there's a co-processor down the bottom here. So if you think back to that white background picture, an awful lot of the elements that you saw in separate cabinets are now just parts of an FPGA in the system. The seven camera limit has been broken through, and you can, with these boxes, now the output of the camera is just an IP signal over a gigabit Ethernet, and you can basically stack cameras and interconnect them through these clever boxes which act as switches and power supplies till the cows come home. And boy, do the cows come home, because if we look at this, this is a real picture of an installation. If any of you has had, I was going to say misfortune, but it's not that bad. If any of you have seen the film Beowulf, this is the set of the film Beowulf. And one of these things here is Ray Winston, and one of them's Angelina Jolie, and one of them's Anthony Hopkins, or could be, because they certainly spent time inside here. So this customer has really broken the bank and has gradually, it's Sony Pictures, and they've gradually wanted bigger and bigger and bigger systems. And here there are about 200 cameras. And the reason that they felt, we didn't advise them to buy 200 cameras, but we weren't upset when they decided to do so. The reason that they wanted to do so, well, I'll show you in the next couple of slides, because they wanted to be able to capture not only the whole body movement of the characters, you really should go and see the film because it's cleverly done, but they also wanted to catch the nuance of the facial movements, as you saw in that clip I showed at the very beginning of the whole sequence. And so some of these cameras are wide angle and are catching characters as they move around within the space. Others are narrow angle and are just looking through a frustum out from the lens right across the space, so that as someone's face fleetingly passes through the field of view of that camera, you get detail on the face with quite a high resolution. It does work. I personally thought it was overkill, but I bit my tongue, and it does work. And they've made now, they're making another film with the director who really likes to. What can anyone remember? What? No, what's Zemeckis is the director. What's the next film they're doing? I can't remember. Well, no marketeers here, clearly. So there's another film being made by the same technique at the moment. It might be. Actually, with time, it is perhaps worth just giving a bit of historical context, because I've leapt from a picture of a girl representing a patient in a gait analysis lab to a film. When did that happen and why did it happen? We started, the business grew quite substantially, selling to hospitals orthopedics, and largely used for measuring gait analysis, and I'll show you an example of that. Mostly used by orthopedic surgeons for studying children with cerebral palsy. In the mid-1990s, the penny began rather slowly, I have to admit, to drop, that we had developed a system which was quite relevant to what was then a very rapidly growing industry of computer games. In the late 1990s, if you had an idea for a computer game, you could go up to London and raise £1 million, easy as falling off a log. And with any luck, you'd then come back to Oxford and spend 100,000 of it on buying a motion capture system. So there was, for a wonderful period, a huge expansion of the games industry in the UK. And it was matched by an expansion of Hollywood's interest in computer graphics. And that transition from simply selling systems to hospitals to selling to Industrial Light and Magic and Digital Domain and other companies really happened very rapidly between about 1995 and 2000. And today, just to complete the picture, about half of the company's production goes to entertainment applications of one sort or another, the other half being a mixture of various other applications. Now, I talked about the laborious way of calibrating those original four cameras, and you might think, well, good Lord, they've got rather a big problem here. But our clever software engineers have come up with this device. So if I screw my pointer onto this little bar, I can now show you the Vicon dance of calibration. So this is how you calibrate a Vicon system. We've got a stick here. There are people who believe it matters how you dance and you get a good calibration or a bad calibration. But what we have here is a little stick with three markers on, and the ones on the edge are exactly 240 millimeters apart. And as I wave it around and capture it simultaneously from all those cameras, I'm able to do a multi-camera calibration. Something rather close to something called multi-view geometry, because what's the difference between looking simultaneously with 200 cameras at an object moving around, or having one camera that moves successively through 200 positions and observes points? Mathematically, there's very little difference indeed, which is why it led to our... We'd had previous work going on with Andrew Blake, and it was why when systems started to get more complex like this, we came in to see Andrew Zisserman and Andrew Fitzgibbon, and that led to the development of another of our businesses, 2D3. But that's another story. Anyway, that's how you calibrate Vicon systems these days, by waving a wand. There are big ones for large volumes like that. But your problems are by no means over. So this chap's reappeared with the dots all over his face. And the large picture on the right is what our clever camera puts out over the network that goes back to the main computer in the system. Each of these is a marker. And in fact, if you squint, you can just make out the shape of a face here. There's two lips here without markers on. There's a blank space here with a nose because it doesn't move much. And there are a couple of eyes. So there's a sort of slanted... Which way around is it? I can't work out. There's a head slightly slanted. You might just be able to see. And over on the left-hand side, this is only a diagnostic display, really. But you can see that camera number 83 is detecting all these markers out there in space. And in this case, the camera has worked out with sub-pixel precision where the center of the marker is in the image, and also what size the marker is. Over here are some markers which it wasn't very sure about, because we've designed the system so that if it's uncertain, it sends you the raw data. But there isn't really time to go into that. So there's an awful lot of markers seen by one camera, but when you look at the problem the other way around, it gets even more horrendous, because now we're showing the rays. I've just put the scale here to give you an idea of what each character is making. So each of these sets of dots out here, there's a face, and here's the body. Now, all these rays are the rays from a single point seen by maybe 30 or 40 cameras. So the problem, the geometrical problem, which has to be done by the software, is from, in this case, 200 cameras looking at somewhere around 1,500 points to generate the 3D location. And if markers are lined up, it's got to figure out which one is the correct one. It's a really quite complicated problem, and we put a lot of man years into making this work properly. And at the end of all that, you've got a cloud of points, but you still don't know which one is which. So then you've got the next problem, if I've got my slides in the right order, of figuring out which points. Now, to illustrate that, I've shown a very much more simple case. This is somebody's arm. Their shoulder's up here, and that's on their upper arm, elbow, wrist, and this is their thumb and hand here. So we've got some markers, and we've got a reasonable idea of which point is which, and the green lines represent that. But what is very commonly the case is that that labelling process or correspondence problem has to be solved in real time. And so we generate quite a detailed kinematic model of the subject, and we go through a process which I'll show you in a moment called subject calibration, which generates for us the kinematic model scaled to an individual subject. And you see these clouds here. These represent the covariant, the ellipsoids of covariance of the estimated marker position relative to the skeleton. So that if you've got a... This is something John and I used to discuss even back then, the bag of bones idea, that if you've got a, as I have, a wobbly bit in the front, and you stick a marker on it, it's going to have a very large uncertainty about where the marker may be. But if you stick a marker on my head, that ellipsoid should be very small. And by using that, it's possible in real time to actually work out how the skeleton fits inside this cloud of points, so that you can produce the kinematics of the skeleton in real time. And here's the sort of movement that we ask, ideally, that actors go through. What this skeleton is doing obediently is putting its joints through a nice full range of motion so that we get a good description of what we know, that the elbow can't go backwards. And so we've worked out another dance. I hadn't realized before this talk how much dancing comes into Bicon and motion capture. But we've worked out another ritualistic dance, so we've got one dance for the camera calibration, and we've got another one here for the subject calibration. So this is the dance of the subject calibration. Now, clearly some people, and particularly children with cerebral palsy or disabled patients, can't manage this. But we tend to use simpler marker sets. But this is certainly the sort of thing that if you're wanting to do a really high quality real-time tracking of an individual subject, that you would ask them to try and go through. Okay, now I'm just going to close by running quickly through some applications. I've already referred to clinical gait analysis, and I'm sorry about the low volume. There's no advantage in you hearing the commentary, which is distracting me. But if you see the child on the top left, you can see that they have markers on their lower limbs distributed very similarly to those in the first shot. And the objective of this whole process is to produce a set of graphs, and this set here would, for example, represent the graphs in the sagittal plane here. Here's the knee movement for a normal person. So when you walk along, your knee bends a little bit while you're standing on it. This is the moment when your toe leaves the ground and your knee flexes a lot more. This is your ankle dorsiflexing as you go over it like that. And then as you go up on your toe, it comes down here, and then very rapidly you lift your toe up again. So one of the other interesting phenomena of the evolution of this system has been that we developed this in collaboration with orthopedic surgeons in the States, Jim Gage and others. We developed a protocol about 1992 for doing gait analysis. And one of the oddities has been that it's been extraordinarily difficult to persuade anyone to leave that protocol behind, because it's a ridiculously oversimplified representation of the skeleton. Joints like the ankle are represented as pin joints, and the knee, all the stuff that has come out of the years and years of research by John and others into the polycentricity of knee joints and things like that. If you start trying to put that into the model, this is a bit of a generalization, but an awful lot of people will say, I don't want it changed. I've got a database of patient stuff that goes back 15 years, and what I want to be able to do today is compare my patients with that. So actually, by coming out with a protocol quite early on in the process, to some extent, everything got frozen, and that has been part of the reason why the whole business of motion capture has been driven forward largely by other applications than gait analysis. I'm going to show you two examples of engineering ergonomic applications. This is a camera I didn't describe in detail inside a BMW, and quite obviously BMW here are interested in how people climb in and out of their cars, and this chap's rather good at it. Before a car or any large complex mechanism is designed, increasingly, people do virtual prototyping because carving metal and making physical models is much more expensive than some computers and some graphics software. So this is Ford, and this character here has got is all marked up and has a virtual reality headset on, so that he sees the representation of the car all around him, and he'll be reaching out to see if he can turn the radio on and off and all that sort of thing. And he'll see the radio, and we'll be able to measure whether he bumps into anything on the way. So this will be the first stage, and then this is the second stage, where a rough outline of the car is put together, and it's possible to check that the physical reality matches the virtual model that was created in the first instance. So we come to the animation side of it again, and I've chosen this clip because it links the acting with the output. I think this is actually from the full motion video that goes on the front of a computer game, and I'm told this character is supposed to be Mark Antony. Looks pretty miserable, but anyway. So, and he's overacting like hell down here. But he, like the other characters, has got points all over his face. And it also shows that nowadays the directors want to see what it's going to look like as the actor is performing. So very often a modern director of a CG sequence like this won't be looking at the actor out there, he'll be listening, and he'll be looking at a computer graphic representation. And he may even be moving his virtual camera around so that while the actor is performing, he can actually get different views of his performance. And that is said by directors like Robert Zemeckis to be why they particularly favour making, you know, because the question always arises, if you're making the characters more and more lifelike, why not use real actors and film them? And the answer that is generally given is that it gives you get an awful lot of freedom to move the camera around in a manner that you otherwise wouldn't be able to do. So I've picked out, or someone else picked out on my behalf, just a few films. The main ones that I would pick out from, I don't know anything about the computer games, and I don't know who Brittany is. Unfortunately, I do. Titanic was the first film, and if you ever look at it, you'll see that in the distant shots of the liner, there are little characters wandering around. And the evolution has been of them people getting more and more confident about putting other films where the motion captures characters tend to be lots of figures in the background of these sort of sword and sandal epics, like the Achaeans doing their D-Day landing on the beaches of Morocco, it actually was, not Troy, were mostly motion captured. And likewise, a lot of the people in and around the Colosseum were motion captured. But in other films, I'm trying to see some examples there. Haven't seen many of these films, but certainly in general, people are getting up to the extreme example that we've mentioned already of Beowulf. The lead characters, people are getting much more confident about making the lead characters motion captured. I'm a little bit late, but we did start a bit late, so I'm just going to wind up now. But before I do, if I've got my slide count right, oh no, I haven't got my slide count right. I just thought, because this is what I'm spending some time doing now, I'd show you, this is still a proposal, but for which we're hoping to get some funding. But one of the problems of unmanned aircraft, like the one represented here, is that although the pilots don't have to get out to have a pee, the planes do eventually run out of fuel. And the problem of automatically refueling an autonomous aircraft is considerable, because it's quite difficult, even if you're a clever pilot, to locate the basket, put your probe in, and then hold station while the fuel is flowing. We believe that a vision-based system that would use an awful lot of the software from Vicon would be quite suitable for this purpose. And we've done some feasibility into what precision would be needed in this case. So I've called it No Limits, just because this would be certainly the highest altitude motion capture that we've so far done. But I think that really does run through my list of slides. No, it doesn't. This really is the last one. I put this in at the end because I wanted to come back to the original principle of retroreflection. We're spending a lot of time and money looking at markerless systems. And again, that's another story. But the extraordinary thing is that retroreflection does live after all these years, since 1980. It has been a remarkably robust system of measurement. And I certainly expect it to continue for some time to come. So to conclude, I would like to just, apart from, again, thanking the department very, very much for inviting me to have the opportunity to tell you a little bit about what we've been up to and to explain to those friends who've been saying, as I mentioned, what on earth is it that you do. But I'd particularly like also to thank all the developers that have, or I can almost say generations of developers that have gone through the evolution of the hardware and the software of our motion capture systems, and to the other staff of OMG for making the business such an enjoyable success. And in, I would particularly like to thank this chap, Pete Meddings, my colleague for for 12 years, 15 years. Pete died 3 years ago yesterday, very suddenly and unexpectedly, very shortly after retiring. And although not a developer, Pete must take the credit as the person who, more than any other, has pushed motion capture both for OMG and for the industry as a whole into such a wide range of applications. He was the person who first persuaded us to focus on clinical gait analysis. He was also the person who told us how to diversify into the animation market and so many other things that we've done. And we miss him very much indeed. Thank you.
Two things about him when I first met him at a conference. One was that he liked snorkeling, and the second was that although he was the owner of the company and managing director and so forth, the thing that he liked the most was talking about science and engineering. And that's true to this day, I'm sure. And we've seen that come through in the lecture today. So please join me in thanking Julian again.